Wonderful to see you all here again. And I hope the session is going well for you. That this rather unusual way of gathering together, of really looking deeply at our hearts and minds, is beneficial for you, that you're finding during these turbulent times a little bit of ease, comfort, and maybe even inspiration as we sit together. As you all know, we're kind of adding to the traditional six paramitas. And I'm going to add another one. And this one, I don't think, is in any of the traditional lists within the Buddhist tradition. I want to talk about humility. I think humility, along with chastity, must be one of the most disavowed virtues in our modern times. Pride, assertiveness, confidence, those have kind of pushed humility, I think, to the side. So now we're told to portray ourselves in the best light, to extol our positive aspects, make an impression, pad our resume. That's what we're told. Humility has become the doormat virtue, kind of scorned as weakness, the forgotten virtue in the contemporary world. Surely humility is an anathema to our modern age. It seems image, more than anything, takes center stage as we obsess about appearing as positively and as strongly as possible. That great promoter of capitalism and probably libertarianism, the writer and philosopher Ayn Rand, wrote, "Discard the protective rags of that vice which you call a virtue, humility. Learn to value yourself, which means fight for your own happiness. And when you learn that pride is the sum of all virtues, you will learn to live like a man." I think Donald Trump must have read that book many times. So I think, you know, at best, humility is the kind of virtue we recommend to other people rather than attempting to have it for ourselves. Self-empowerment, self-centeredness, strong self-esteem, self-expression are all eagerly sought in contemporary society. Never be wrong, never show doubt, don't hesitate, don't back down. I think these are some of the messages perhaps that have replaced the message of humility. And certainly, you know, social media like Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat tend to encourage vanity and self-promotion. So is there any place for humility in this me culture? Well, the ancient traditions of the world certainly thought humility does have a place and highly valued humility, indeed saw it as absolutely necessary for social harmony. Most religions proclaim humility as a profound part of the spiritual path. Here's a quote from the Tao Te Ching, the Taoist text. "I have three precious things which I hold fast and prize. The first is gentleness, the second is frugality, and the third is humility, which keeps me from putting myself before others. Be gentle and you can be bold. Be frugal, and you can be liberal. Avoid putting yourself before others, and you can become a leader among men. And in the same breath, almost, the ancient traditions point out that being humble is not being a doormat. And instead, these same traditions stress the absolute importance of each person. Rabbi Simcha Bunim of Peshitta, who lived in the 1700s, used to say that everyone should keep a piece of paper with, "For my sake, the world was created," in one pocket, and a piece of paper with, "I am but dust and ashes," in another pocket. Isn't that interesting? In one pocket, "For my sake, the world was created." And in the other pocket, "I am but dust and ashes." So you could pull out one or the other of these little slips of paper, depending on the situation, to remind yourself. And certainly both are true, aren't they? I wonder if you took up this practice, what you would write on two slips of paper, one for the left pocket, one for the right. So really, what are we talking about? What is humility? Well, humility comes from the Latin word humilitas, which derives from humus, earth or soil, same word that we have in English today. And soil, as we know, is a complex mixture of minerals, water, air, organic matter, and countless organisms that are digesting the remains of once living things. Soil, as one naturalist point out, is the beginning of all fertility for the whole earth. It is the skin of the earth, out of which all life begins. And are we not creatures of the earth? Not only living on the earth, but actually made of the earth. Certainly the Abrahamic prophets really believe so. According to Genesis, the book of Genesis in the Hebrew Bible or the Old Testament, "And the Lord God formed man of the dust of the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living soul." And in the Quran, it is written, "We created the human being from the quintessence of clay." And I was reading recently that current scientific thought speculates that life on Earth began from water, the kind of richness of rock or the soil, and some source of energy, these three things coming together to create life. So humility, in this sense, is deeply rooted in the ground, in nature, and so unconcerned with success, opinions, and attitudes. And personally, I find it quite soothing to imagine my link to the soil and water, that whenever I look down, I see the ground, the very source of my being. And returning to our source, returning to that ground, to who we fundamentally are, without the stories, expectations, and criticism, we could say is the practice of humility. In the early Christian tradition, Humility was understood to be when a person had a modest estimate of their own worth or ability and submitted to others. Saint Bernard of Clairvaux, who revitalized the monastic tradition within the Catholic Church somewhere in the 1200s, said this about humility: a virtue by which a man, knowing himself as he truly is. Which sounds pretty good. But then Saint Bernard went on to say, and abases himself. So maybe this is why humility is not so much in vogue these days. It carries along with the good quality of self-knowing the early Christian idea of submission or obedience. And perhaps, in addition, the Victorian idea of talking about your own accomplishments in public as vulgar or somewhat impolite. And perhaps the current dismissal of humility is in part a reaction to false humility. When we find ourselves almost tricked into proclaiming someone else's strong points in reaction to their kind of humble statements or protests of unworthiness. And we're not sure if they actually believe what they're saying about themselves or not, or just looking for a little encouragement, acknowledgement. So in modern Western society, then, we are taught to dispense with both false and what we may call a genuine humility. First, for its falseness to our sense of self and annoyance that we give others when we try to use false humility. And the second, for its seemingly absent utility in the materialistic world, which is so often dominated by competition and ambition. Like the quote we just heard from Saint Bernard, Western religious and spiritual perspectives tend to see humility and its identification with the earth, the ground, as a kind of abasing, implying a kind of lowliness or meekness or perhaps even low self-esteem. And this abasement was seen as kind of positive in that it serves in one way or another to place the individual below the divine, however the divine is understood. However, one of the early Buddhist texts actually turns this view around. Rather than abasement, identity with the earth cultivates a heart of equanimity. When the Buddha was instructing his son, Rahula, in meditation, he recommended to develop a mind that is stable and as accepting as the earth herself. Here's the Buddha's words. Rahula, develop the meditation in tune with earth. For when you are developing the meditation in tune with earth, agreeable and disagreeable sensory impressions that have arisen will not stay in charge of your mind and heart. Just as when people throw what is clean or unclean on the earth, feces, urine, saliva, pus, or blood, the earth is not horrified, humiliated, or disgusted by it. In the same way, when you are developing the meditation in tune with earth, agreeable and disagreeable sensory impressions that have arisen will not take charge of your mind and heart. So in this sense, I think we could say humility is opening to the equanimity of the earth, not offended and not humiliated. Just there, present. I find it interesting that humility and humiliation are so close. In humility, we identify ourselves with the earth. In humiliation, perhaps we are thrown down on the earth. Opening to the great beauty and vastness of the earth and nature also brings forward a sense of humility. A few days ago, Kate and I went outside before going to bed to see the blue moon, bright and hard against the dark sky. It evoked in me a sense of awe and a sense of humility. And surely each of us has experienced something similar when we attend to the beauty and wonder of the natural world. The waves at the beachside, snowy peaks of the Rockies or Mount Baker, a star-filled sky, perhaps the vast open desert or the depth of a forest, or maybe the might of a storm. I think we can all name a time, a place, when we felt humble in the presence of the natural world. When we attend with mindfulness and awareness to the natural world, often a sense of humility arises with an acknowledgement of both our smallness, but also our interdependence. And sometimes we can interpret the smallness as kind of insignificance, that I am not significant. But when we really attend carefully, when we know that we are a part of this, that we stand within, not outside, then the judgment around the smallness drops away. And these precious moments of humility in the natural world guide us to act with a gentle and unpresupposing tenderness towards all living beings and towards the earth itself. And during those moments, we also become aware of how much one's life is dependent upon factors outside our control. Intuiting our smallness and interdependence and aware of the complex and harmonious interrelationships that connect us, humility naturally arises. And this view of humility that I think arises when we are attentive and aware in nature resonates deeply with the Buddhist tradition. Buddhism embraces humility, that quality of truly knowing oneself and awareness of the interdependence. But unlike the earlier views of humility that include abasement, as we saw, for example, in St. Bernard, the Buddhist tradition cautions us against any kind of comparison. The Buddhist tradition sees all comparison of oneself with others as a form of conceit. In Sanskrit, conceit is translated as mana. And I'd like you to read to you a short passage from one of the early Buddhist texts. And this text defines mana or conceit. And I'd like you to notice how different it is from the usual meaning of conceit. So here it goes. This is the definition. being inferior to somebody and considering that one is inferior, being inferior and considering that one is equal, being inferior and considering that one is superior, being equal and considering that one is inferior, being equal and considering that one is equal, being equal and considering that one is superior, being superior and considering that one is inferior, being superior and considering that one is equal, being superior and considering that one is superior. So what this text is telling us is that mana, or this conceit, this constant comparison of ourselves to others, is problematic. It divides it into three categories, as we just saw, right? Superior, equal, and inferior. So viewing yourself as superior to somebody, viewing yourself as inferior to someone, and viewing yourself as equal to someone are all problematic. These are all forms of conceit. All these views are just stories that get in the way of who we truly are. So in the Buddhist tradition, humility is free of all comparison. So let's just look at this just a little bit more. The conceit of seeing yourself as superior is certainly promoted by much of modern culture with its focus on self-promotion. But the other two are particularly important for us to be aware of. To see oneself as inferior is also an ego trap that can blind us and bind us just as strongly as trying to act in a superior way. The inferiority story is one that I grapple with. And at times, well, and I suspect this is true for many of us here, it keeps me from acting with honesty and clarity. Perhaps you have felt that too. And while not seeing ourselves as superior or inferior to somebody else, that we can fairly easily understand, but it may seem strange to not see ourselves as equal, right? That seems a little bit more challenging. After all, isn't equality good? But the text is telling us seeing ourselves just as good as someone else is also just the story we're telling ourselves, when there is really no need for any comparison at all. The point is not to engage in any kind of comparative story, but to simply see things as they are, to see ourselves as we are. So I'd like to suggest that the Buddhist idea of humility accepts St. Bernard's statement of truly knowing oneself, sensing one's place in the cosmos, we could say. But rather than adding a quality of abasement or obedience, calls upon us to drop all comparisons. All comparisons, favorable, unfavorable, and neutral. And when we do this, our strong sense of individuality and self becomes a little more porous, accepting and open. So humility, remember, as I said earlier, comes from the Latin word for earth or ground. And our practice, both on the cushion and off the cushion, is to see where we are at this moment, to be aware of the ground that we stand on, that we sit upon. So this brings forward one more aspect of, or perhaps shade of meaning to humility, at least in the Buddhist context. It is the aspect of letting go. So in addition to dropping the game of being better or worse than somebody else, we also have to let go of how things should be and profoundly accept what is. So again, in the Buddhist context, humility returns us to the groundlessness, to the groundless ground of our interdependence and interpenetration. Humility is realizing through our mind, heart, and body that we are not separate from anything else. Humility, the dropping of all comparison of these stories, seeing clearly, deeply who we are, allows us to reaffirm our intimacy with the ever-changing and alive ground of all life. I've noticed that the more we return to humility, the more confidence we develop in our life exactly as it is. And this is not a prideful, arrogant confidence that's based on some accomplishment or talents. Because really, part of humility is the deep understanding, the deep seeing that all our accomplishments are really the fruit of countless people's efforts. Those who came before us and taught us and showed us everything from how to write our names to making a really good grilled cheese sandwich. All of these things come from others. The great musicians of the world are only great due to the genes they inherited and the teachers who taught them, support of others in many ways, and of course their dedication and their hard work. I don't want to dismiss that either. But also consider, please, the teachers of your teachers, and then the teachers of those teachers, and so on back into the midst of time. Any story of our greatness, when we consider that, also begins to recede into the mist. So I mentioned that when we open to humility, as we open to humility, then the more confident we become. Because in humility, we don't have to stick up, right? We don't have to outshine the people beside us and around us. Since we are touching in humility the ground of all being, instead of striving to be that someone special, our humility allows us to be much, much more than that. We become free to be who we are in that moment. Nobody to defend or uphold. Nobody to compare. Nobody who needs to constantly check if they are up to snuff. We could say that humility is the effort through which the self attempts to free itself of its illusions about itself. Free of illusion, confidence and integrity shine forth. Let me illustrate that a little bit. Suzuki Roshi, the Japanese monk who brought our form of Zen practice from Japan to North America in the 60s, gave a talk on the Sandokai, the merging of difference of unity texts that we chant sometimes. Any rate, in those talks, Suzuki Roshi taught that true confidence was bigger than something we strive for. Rather, it is an abiding quality that is part of our interconnectedness, and it arises through our humility. So here is a couple of quotes from Suzuki Roshi about confidence, or as he calls it in this text, self-respect. When you are just you, without thinking or trying to say something special, just saying what is on your mind and how you feel, then there is naturally self-respect. When I feel something, I'm also a part of it, but not quite. When you do something without any feeling of having done something, then that is you, yourself. You are completely with everyone, and you don't feel self-conscious. That is self-respect. When you speak or act, it will be just to express yourself. That is complete self-respect. To practice Zazen is to attain this kind of self-respect. While we were talking about self-respect, a bird was singing outside. Peep, peep, peep. That is self-respect. Peep, peep, peep. Quite beautiful, I think. I enjoy reading the transcripts of his talks. So how do we cultivate or open to this idea of humility in the Buddhist tradition? Well, I'd like to suggest two ways that are connected to the body. And I particularly decided to try connect this to the body in honor of our Shuso Kakuko Kei's teachings during this practice period on the body. So both of these practices, of course, do come from the Buddhist tradition. So here goes. In Japan, it's customary to say a very short grace before each meal. And the word that is spoken is itadakimasu, which is basically a polite way to simply say, I receive. And here is how one Japanese Buddhist teacher explains this simple grace, teaching how humility and gratitude are really kind of woven together. The original intention was to express appreciation for a meal, saying to the food placed before one, thank you. Thank you for giving up your life so that my own life can be extended. When we see that human beings do not occupy a special, privileged place in the web of life, then humility and gratitude should be natural and spontaneous. When we realize that we are all sustained by both visible and invisible forces in our world, we should be humble and grateful. Itadakimasu. Saying of itadakimasu before every meal is a practice of humility based on compassion for other beings and gratitude at the role they serve in our interdependent lives. Perhaps you already have a grace or expression of gratitude before eating. But if not, you could say, itadakimasu. Or maybe you could simply say, I receive. I receive. Or you could create your own words to remind yourself of this profound interconnection and sharing. So the other practice I'd like to suggest is the practice of bowing. Now, in Japan, there's a very complicated social etiquette connected to bowing, involving how many times and how deep one bows, and to whom. And at times, it can kind of result in a rather humorous contest of who will bow the deepest, the longest, and the most often. And more than once, I have seen two elderly women bowing and bowing to each other, neither willing to be the last one to bow. Or the first one to stop, I should say. But overall, in Japan, The sense of bowing is usually warm, conveying respect and deep bodily acknowledgement of the other person. So here is how Suzuki Roshi, touching back on him, explained bowing in the Zen tradition. He wrote, or rather spoke, "By bowing, we are giving up ourselves. To give up ourselves means to give up our dualistic ideas. So there's no difference between Zen practice and bowing. Usually, to bow means to pay respects to someone, which is more worthy of respect than ourselves. But when you bow to Buddha, you are already Buddha. When you become one with Buddha, one with everything that exists, you find the true meaning of being. You find the true meaning of bowing." He goes on a little bit, I'm skipping it just a little bit. "When you forget all your dualistic ideas, everything becomes your teacher, and everything can be an object of worship. When everything exists within your big mind, all dualistic relationships drop away. There is no distinction between heaven and earth, man and woman, teacher and disciple. Sometimes a man bows to a woman. Sometimes a woman bows to a man. Sometimes the disciple bows to the master. Sometimes the master bows to the disciple. A master who cannot bow to his disciple cannot bow to Buddha. Sometimes the master and disciple bow together to Buddha. Sometimes we bow to cats and dogs." Sometimes I bow to trees, and sometimes I bow to waterfalls and streams. And sometimes I bow when I overhear a word of kindness spoken by someone. But I know I don't bow enough. I want to bow more. And I hope you will take up the practice of bowing. Physically, bowing is quite powerful, but so is simply bowing in your heart. One teacher expressed bowing like this: we lower the head below the heart, certainly when we do full prostrations. We lower the head below the heart. Let's keep doing that. I'll end with one short quote from Zokitsu Norman Fisher, the founding teacher of Mountain Rain, and we were fortunate to be able to hear his words last night. I can't remember where I found this piece, but here goes. "A long time ago, when I was serving as Katagiri Roshi's attendant," he was a Japanese Zen priest who had come over to help Suzuki Roshi way back in the late 60s. "So a long time ago, when I was serving as Katagiri Roshi's attendant, I noticed that he always mumbled something as he bowed. I asked him what it was, but he couldn't tell me since it was in Japanese. And later on, I received in the mail a translation of the bowing verse that he mumbled, and which I have used ever since." Here's the verse: "Bower and what is bowed to are empty by nature. The bodies of oneself and other are not two. I bow with all beings to attain liberation. I bow to manifest the unsurpassable mind and return to the boundless truth." Let me read that just one more time. Bauer and what is bowed to are empty by nature. The bodies of oneself and other are not two. I bow with all beings to attain liberation. I bow to manifest the unsurpassable mind and return to the boundless truth. And let us continue our practice of bowing, our practice of sitting together. And our practice of gratitude as we deepen our humility and let that lead us into all of the other paramitas that we have been looking at through this practice period together. Thank you.